Black Friday at BJ's Wholesale Club is so big, we called in the expert at paying less around the holidays.
Scrooge here. Past, present, or future, it's hard to beat the Black Friday deals at BJ's. Believe me, I've tried. Get 25% off select toys, 30% off select small appliances, and 45% off select TVs through December 1st. Plus, doorbuster deals Thanksgiving weekend. These prices are so good they even rattled old Marley's chain. Ah, humbug. Sorry, old habit.
Visit BJ's.com/Black Friday for holiday savings.
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your podcast dedicated to Newcastle United, brought to you by The Athletic FC. I'm George Culkin, and as you may have already guessed, we are Taylor Payne free this weekend because our venerable host is poorly sick. So get well soon, son. The good news, is it good news? I'm not so sure. But the good news is that we have a detailed record of Newcastle's trip to Brighton's Amex Arena as logged by Train Geordie Train, as we like to call him, aka the South Coast's Chris Woff. Let's have a listen to that and then we can get into the game.
So I'm stood here on platform 3 at Newcastle Central Station. The time is 12:50 on Saturday lunchtime. I'm waiting for a train 7 minutes time. Nosebleed hasn't started yet, but I am a bit concerned. I've had a sausage already this morning, a Geordie Bangers, and I'm waiting. I've already packed loads of goodies for the train. I've got hot drinks, I've got brownies, I've got beef empanadas, I think they are, but yeah, I'm a bit concerned. Don't know if they'd serve food down south. Anyway, I'm getting this first train, then I'm going to change across at St Pancras and all the way down to Brighton. It's a heck of a long way down south, I think, but yeah, let's see how this goes, and I blame George for all of this. Got off the train at Brighton, and let me just tell you that, yeah, it is a bloody long way south, and I don't think my nose is quite bleeding, but I think I've got a bit of a headache. This is very strange for me, and yeah, I just want to explain to you. So let's just walk through to where I'm staying now, and yeah, this is a bit unusual. So I'm walking up to my door, and there is a picture of Darth Vader waiting for me in my hotel room. So yeah, it's you know, maybe you hear the click of the door there. So I walk into my room, and immediately to my left there is Star Wars Episode 1. An incredible cross-sections book. There's a Darth Vader outfit. There's a lightsaber, which I can turn on. Oh, there, so you make a noise. Can you hear that? There you go, lightsaber. And I'm just walking into my room, and it is very much a Star Wars-themed room. And yes, I shit you not, genuinely, for reasons which I won't go into. But basically, this turned out to be the cheapest option for me of a reasonable place to stay in the bank holiday weekend in Brighton. Nobody wanted the Star Wars room in this hotel, which is a themed hotel. So up on the wall there are various different blasters of various descriptions. I have a bunk bed as if you were in Darth Vader's quarters. There are some orange gowns as if you're like members of the rebellion, I suppose, probably. And if you go into the shower, the bathroom, the shower has a curtain which has Han Solo frozen in carbonite as the actual shower curtain, and on the walls are weird pictures of Leia, Ahsoka, various other members of the Star Wars, Anakin, various other members of the Star Wars fraternity. So yes, this weekend, which was always going to be unusual for me. Also, I've got DVDs of every single Star Wars film if I want to watch them tonight. So yes, this has been an unusual trip so far, me coming down south, and it's been even weirder by the fact that I'm going to spend the night in Darth Vader's quarters. So yes, I will fill you in the morning on what that is actually like. Just starting the day as every Darth Vader room person stayer should, and that's to with my lightsaber. Yes, anyway, so today is actually May the 4th, rather strangely, ironically. Not really sure why this turned out to be one of the cheapest rooms that I get in Brighton when it is May the 4th. Clearly, Star Wars aficionados did not rush down. Anyway, yes, I've woken up. I have not Walking up in a black suit and being turned into some sort of cyborg. I am and remain Chris Woff, Nosebleed territory down south, but I have just been for a little jog along Brighton seafront. I had to stop three times, basically just doing 4.5k, so I am pathetic compared to Run Jody Run. It just makes me... I was wearing a Run Jody Run top, actually, in honour of his run, but yeah, I'm not anywhere near his standard of being able to cover ground. Pretty pathetic, really. But yeah, very lovely sunny day down here. The weather can be quite nice down here. I will give Brighton and the South Coast that, but hopefully Newcastle United can continue making it a lovely day later on by getting a positive result. After Aston Villa's win yesterday, they could do with a win. It's 12:53pm and the team is out, and absolutely no surprises whatsoever. Newcastle are unchanged. Joe Willock continues as the left side at number 8. The only change to the squad is John Ruddy drops out, no longer two keepers, and Sean Neave, the teenager, already has a cup winner's medal despite not yet making a senior appearance for Newcastle, is back on the bench. We await to see where Jason Tindall, who was linked with the QPR job this week but is banned on the touchline services, one match suspension today, where he will watch the match. Will he be in the press box? Will he be elsewhere? But anyway, I also have had a very disturbing conversation with someone who works for the club, who basically, I was telling them about my hotel experience last night, and then he said, oh, I bet you there's been some action in that room, which I hadn't necessarily considered, and now I feel I should have another shower. Anyway, the game is not too far away. Just over an hour it'll kick off, and let's see whether Newcastle United can respond to Aston Villa winning yesterday and put themselves in a very positive top five qualification position.
Retrieves it, finds Minte in the penalty area, cuts inside onto his left, still Minte! And for the second time this season, Yankuba Minte scores against Newcastle United. We've got the equaliser in the FA Cup tie in March, and now he puts Brighton ahead at the Amex Stadium.
Half time, and it is Brighton and Hove Albion 1, Newcastle United 0, and sort of inevitable who is going to be the goal scorer to a certain degree, I suppose. Yankuba Minte has been involved heavily, seemingly getting a bit of criticism from Newcastle United fans, and he cuts inside onto his left foot, completely does Livramento and Tonali, takes him out of the game and curls into the corner, left hand corner via Dan Byrne. Newcastle falling behind. There's been some decent play from Newcastle up until the final third when the decision making's been poor. Alexander Isak hasn't had a touch in the Brighton box yet. He's been almost anonymous. I think the midfield's been relatively poor. I think the wide players haven't been involved enough. Basically, Newcastle just lacked quality and decision making. They're 1-0 behind. Jason Tindall is up in the director's box. It's up between Andy Howe and Paul Mitchell because he served as one match suspension. He wasn't allowed to take the warm up. Graham Jones has been up and down with Eddie Howe. He's been far more vocal with the fourth official than normal, but Newcastle need a bit of a response here. They haven't looked really like scoring since they've fallen behind, and they just need a bit more energy, a bit more something, so I wouldn't be surprised to see some changes fairly early in the second half.
Huge moment. Share into the wall, or they say handball, they get it, penalty. The referee's given them a penalty for the third time, and Alexander Isak up against Barbara Bruggen to bring Newcastle level. Isak scores! Sends the keeper the wrong way. He went low down to Verbruggen's right, and the away end.
Well, that was certainly an eventful second half. The Newcastle players are just walking down the tunnel now. There's just been boos for the referee from the home fans as he's left the field, Craig Pawson. Newcastle, at the third time of asking, were finally awarded a spot kick, which was not overturned. And Newcastle found a way to get a point. It's their first draw since December the 4th. Yeah, it's been a controversial second half. Newcastle weren't brilliant by any stretch, but they did try to force the issue in the second half. They've finally found a way to get that draw, and it could prove very, very important in the Champions League race. Fate remains in their own hand, and this could prove to be an extremely important point at a ground that they have not done particularly well at in recent seasons.
Chris, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I'm slightly bamboozled, more bamboozled than I normally am. It's very difficult to get past the whole Star Wars thing. My main question to you, why does this only happen to you? It's like, why, when like you booked the hotel, did you not just press the button that said Travel Lodge or Premier Inn? Why have you ended up in a Star Wars themed sex hotel, which is clearly what that was? You're there clutching your lightsaber. It's a horrible image for all of us. You were in a swingers hotel in Brighton, Chris, weren't you?
Well, it may well have been. I mean, I didn't see any of that action going on. I don't believe that anyone slept in the bunk bed above me, as far as I can tell. Basically, they were either really, really crap hotels, which were within price range, or it went up to sort of absolute mega prices, given that it was bank holiday weekend in Brighton and there was some sort of music festival going on. And so this was the sort of mid-range option, reasonably priced relative for Brighton. And I thought, you know what, this could actually be quite amusing for the podcast. And I think it has turned out to be.
Well, my reaction is not one of humour, it's just one of sheer fury.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's worthwhile.
I'm also slightly disturbed by your intricate knowledge of all things Star Wars as well, when you're like going through all the characters' names and things like that. I didn't like that.
I mean, I do like Star Wars. I'm not someone who turns up to Comic-Con or anything like that necessarily, but I do like a bit of Star Wars, and so it was very unusual. The Han Solo shower curtain is particularly frightening. there's also as you're having a wee stood over the toilet, there is a the mask that she wears, whatever Anakin's wife is, her name escapes me, in the first one, which is like a white face mask, and that is quite freaky as well in the middle of the night. So yeah, it was an unusual experience, but no, I wouldn't say I regret it necessarily.
Well, Chris Skywanker, as I'm going to call you from now on. I'm also really annoyed now that I think about it that Newcastle managed to draw that game as opposed to losing 3-0, which obviously I don't want to happen, but I sort of did want to happen in order to break you. So I'm sort of a bit irritated by that you've kind of come back from Brighton feeling relatively chirpy.
Yeah, I mean, as I made at the point at the end of the audio blog, my record there is actually relatively decent. I mean, I obviously haven't been there in recent seasons, but
haven't. No, that's right. Yeah, because Muggins here has.
It is relatively decent, but yeah, it's what I think was a pretty good point in the end, which we can come on to in a second. But yeah, I think overall, I wouldn't necessarily say the word successful, but I think it was a good day for Newcastle, considering how positive results had been for Newcastle's rivals over the weekend, that they made sure to get at least something out of the game.
Having slept on it, I am minded to agree with you. But yeah, we'll get into that. So let's start nearer the beginning. And that was a pretty familiar opening for Newcastle at what has become a proper bogey ground for them.
Yeah, it's not somewhere they like visiting. As you mentioned, you were there for the 3-0 under Steve Bruce last season. They were hammered 3-1. I mean, it was nearly 2 years ago now because it was the very start of last season, but that was when Evan Ferguson, remember him, scored a hat-trick and looked like an absolute world beater against Newcastle. They got a 0-0 draw there the season before when really they were absolutely battered and were very fortunate to get that. Brighton in general are a bogey team for Newcastle, certainly in recent years, beyond the 4-1 in the Champions League qualification season. They don't really beat Brighton this season. I've seen Brighton 3 times now, and I have been thoroughly unimpressed with them on the ball each time. You think of Brighton, particularly under De Zerbi, even under Potter, you think they're going to be very good in possession. And I was having a chat with Andy Naylor, our Brighton correspondent, before the game, and he said it's weird because he thought it was going to be a continuation, whereas actually under Hertzler, they've become a lot more sort of physical and athletic, and they've taken on that approach more. And the 3 times, yeah, Brighton have played Newcastle, as I said, I haven't been impressed with them on the ball. They've been dogged, they've dug out results, they've been clinical in terms of the way they've taken chances, but they've just frustrated Newcastle in so many ways, and Newcastle have lacked the killer instinct in the final third, and that's very much what you saw early on. I thought Newcastle had more of the ball early on. I thought they had a lot of clear openings, but then when they got to the final third, they made some very poor decisions. Their final ball was just lacking. The runs overlapping runs that players were making, I didn't think were necessarily the right ones. I thought the midfield were poor on the ball, which is not usually something you associated certainly with Sandro Tonali and Bruno Guimaraes. And then from that, Brighton, again, basically their first shot on target score, and it was almost inevitable, I suppose, who was going to be the player who did score.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about Jakub Minta. I mean, I thought he played very well, actually, having scored against Newcastle in the FA Cup not too long ago and refused to celebrate against a team he never made an appearance for.
Which you were furious about, I remember, in that. I forget that was...
I am furious about that. I get furious at weird things. I mean, I think that is an age. That is an age thing. First Star Wars, sex hotels, then Jakub Minta not celebrating. And then I was more perplexed yesterday. So talk through the goal, first of all, because that's one of your favourite things to do. And then we'll get on to the celebration.
I mean, it was a well-worked goal from a Brighton perspective. Newcastle defended it relatively poorly, and Eddie Howe made this point afterwards. He sort of said, you know, Jakub Minna wants to cut in his left foot, but actually stopping it is difficult. I suppose the Mo Salah effect to a lesser degree. But the ball's out on the left-hand side. Adingra crosses with his right foot into the box. Tino Livramento tries to head the ball away. It goes as far as Vifa, who plays a really, really good no-look pass, essentially, blind pass to Jakub Minna on the right-hand side of the box, who stands up Livramento, then dinks, comes inside, takes out Livramento and Tonali, then curls a left-footed shot, which Fabian Schär's maybe had a chance of clearing off the line, but it takes a very slight deflection off Dan Byrne and goes in. But it was a very tidy finish, frustrating from a Newcastle point of view. And yeah, then I will let you take up the next bit as to what happened immediately afterwards.
Well, if you do the granular match action, I'll do the granular celebration action. So Minta scores. He then, it seems to be kind of fairly similar to what happened at St. James's. He does a praying motion with his hands. He's pointing to the whole away end. So that feels to me like a sort of placatory gesture. He's again saying, I'm not going to celebrate. And then, you know, the camera cuts away and then it's cutting back to him. And he now suddenly starts to look angry. So, I mean, I'm assuming that things have been sort of shouted back at him, because having started by trying to sort of play things down, he ends up pointing at his badge and then pointing at the turf for some reason, and then is even kissing his badge before he gets hauled off. I mean, that's more like it, surely. I mean, come on, A, celebrate your goal, but then get a bit pissed off. But yeah, it was very weird, that whole thing. I don't know what your take on it was.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't fully seen it at the time. The replays are sort of cut away at the ground, but then I think you were messaging in the sort of chat that we have as the game is going on, and sort of said it, and so I saw it back, and it was odd, and there was a lot of debate about it within the sort of press box and within the ground, and I think it eventually... I don't think some Newcastle fans in the away end had immediately realised exactly how to celebrate it, but then I think word filtered through to them. And then there was some chance of you just a SH1 to the Timmy T, Jakub Murphy and the like to Jakub Minna, which is a bit of an odd reaction to the fact he had also just scored and put Brighton 1-0 ahead. But also, I do also get it, and there's a sort of amusing element to that. But yeah, it all felt a bit curious. It all felt like he flipped from wanting to show respect to his side, and then he obviously heard something. I assume he heard something, and then it railed him. It was a bit puzzling, and his teammates, he seemed to be furious at his teammates, who had to basically calm him down. It was a very odd reaction to scoring a goal, which would put your side ahead.
I thought he played really well. I think he does look like a good player. I mean, it's weird. Kind of, we wrote a piece that went up on The Athletic straight after the game, and kind of I said in that, it's like it's so strange how a player who didn't play a single minute for Newcastle has kind of somehow played such an important role in the club's recent existence. Yeah, knocking them out, helping to knock them out of the FA Cup, and then again scoring yesterday. But of course, that £30 million that he brought in last summer was vital to Newcastle avoiding breaching PSR. And without that, they would not be in this position now in the league. I mean, it's kind of strange to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, earlier, just on him playing well early on, I think Newcastle reacted to this quite well, but early on, it was obvious that Brighton were trying to target the space in behind Livramento and trying to get Minta one-on-one with Dan Byrne, and they had quite a lot of joy with that early on. You also had Vifa following up quite close behind, and also O'Reilly following up to try and get numbers into that position, because they knew Livramento would attack and go forward. Newcastle responded relatively well to it, but yeah, I think that Minta, he showed that athleticism, that is very good left foot. There's still a rawness about him, but he is also only 2021, and this is his first season in the Premier League, so that's what you get with a lot of Brighton's players. There are clear, obvious qualities there, but like when we saw with Belieber, who just launched one ball from the middle of the pitch out of play to the left-hand side, there are also mistakes within that Brighton side.
I'd eat orchid.
So that goal came after 28 minutes, and at that point, it's, oh dear, this isn't going terribly well. Now, you touched on some of this stuff a little earlier. This was not a kind of vintage Newcastle performance. We knew that this was a huge opportunity for them to, you know, if they'd won against Brighton, they'd have gone within a couple of points of Arsenal, who were second, and it felt like, is this going to be one of those days at the office? So let's talk about that sort of thing. It's funny, you and I, Chris, are in a group, a chat group with a friend of ours who was being incredibly negative all the way through this match. Oh, the big players haven't turned up. That's terrible. It's one of those awful. You know, they're playing terribly. This is awful. And it's sort of that does tend to sort of affect your own viewpoint. I never thought it was quite that bad, I have to say. And then I think we should sort of save what this point actually means for Newcastle until the end. But at that point, this wasn't a kind of great performance from Newcastle. And I think it was valid to sort of be asking the question, have they turned up?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it was an odd game, and particularly in the first half, until the Minter goal, really, there was no real goal-mouth action in terms of actual clear-cut chances. It was... Newcastle, I thought, looked quite good until the final third. I thought there was a lot of decent sort of build-up play. It was interesting, after the game, Dan Byrne talked about how, this was noticeable, but it became even more obvious once he'd said it, that Newcastle had set up tactically differently. They didn't press as aggressively as they often do, because Brighton have caught them off guard with that this season. So they took it, they approached it in a slightly different way. They took the right moments to press, they looked to attack and transition when they could. But then they got the final third and there was just nothing really there. I mean, Alexander Isak didn't have a single touch in the opposition box in the first half. I think his penalty, which we'll come on to later, was his second touch in the opposition box, and that came in the 89th minute. So he was just almost anonymous in the large spells of the game. Newcastle are struggling to get him in games at the moment. He doesn't necessarily look, whether it's fully fit or whether it's fully engaged or whether there's just a disconnect with his teammates at the moment, it just isn't quite working for him and for them. But I also, as I said before, I didn't think Brighton were particularly good. I thought that Newcastle were the better team in terms of until the final third. I thought they looked like progressing it better. They looked like they had a better idea of what they were trying to do. Whereas Brighton, Minter aside and sort of attacking down that side early on, I wasn't quite clear what their exact game plan was. I mean, it was interesting that Howe was asked afterwards, because this was a game where Jason Tindall served his one-match ban from the touchline for collecting three yellow cards. He was not allowed on the pitch area at all. So before the game, having taken the warm-up when he was in temporary charge, he did not take the warm-up for this match. He was allowed into the dressing room, so he was there before the game, but then he took his seat in the director's box between Paul Mitchell and Andy Howe during the game. Everyone else is in suits, and he sat there in his tracksuit. But I think that his presence was missed to a certain degree on the touchline. Graham Jones was getting up, and every now and again would have a word with the fourth official. Eddie Howe was having a word with the fourth official more often than normal. But there was a moment, and this is jumping forward, but there's a moment in the second half where... I think it's after the second penalty is overturned, where Eddie Howe immediately and quite obviously gestures to Nick Pope three times that he needs to basically go down injured, and then he does go down injured. Now, Newcastle have done this before, but usually there's a slight more subtlety to it, and I think that Jason Tindall brings that, and I don't know whether that sort of direction...
You're saying Jason Tindall is subtle.
Well, exactly, yeah, it's complete opposite of what you would expect, but it just felt, yeah, it felt like everyone was not quite in their comfort zone because of that, and that may be making too big a thing of it, but it just, after the fact, I sort of just felt like... At times, Eddie Howe admitted afterwards, he said that, you know, it wasn't an experience he wanted to necessarily repeat again, not having Jason Tindall there. I don't know whether you think I'm making far too much of that, but it was just interesting watching that, because the press box at Brighton is directly behind the dugout, so you can basically see everything that's going on.
I think that's a good way of putting it, actually, not in comfort zone. I think there was nobody there in that stadium who was in their comfort zone. You weren't in your comfort zone, you just... arrived in the South Coast with a nosebleed, clutching your lightsaber, having spent the night at a sex hotel, Star Wars sex hotel. Eddie Howe, Jason Tindall, as we've already talked about, and the team to a certain extent as well. It wasn't kind of comfort zone territory. They really had to fight and work for the point they got. And somebody else who wasn't in his comfort zone, I have to be a little bit careful here, was the referee Craig Pawson. Now, I say I have to be careful because having railed to a certain extent against the officials last weekend, I was then told off in our comment section on The Athletic for talking too much about decisions. The interesting thing about this Brighton game is that Craig Pawson did get pretty much everything wrong, but in the end, those decisions turned out to be the right ones through VAR. Yeah, I mean, pretty extraordinary.
Well, just on that, and this again, maybe putting two and two together and it being after the fact, but... To get to the press conference room at Brighton now, you've got to walk basically all the way back round through the bowels of the stadium, and he walked past the referee's room, and Craig Pawson walked past me shaking his head, looking as if he'd had a very difficult afternoon afterwards. Now, as I say, that may not have been why he was shaking his head at that point, but it was sort of, you thought, yeah, this
he was looking at you, Chris, saying, why didn't you just stay in a travel lodge?
Quite possibly. But it was a day where I think VAR actually had a very good day. I mean, it gets criticised a lot, but Eddie Howe couldn't disagree with the decisions afterwards. But before we come on to the penalty instance, there was another incident, and that was Mats Wifa, who is a midfielder but was playing at fullback for Brighton, had already been booked, and he then catches Tonali late in the middle of the pitch, early in the second half.
Yeah.
Clearly, if he hadn't already been booked, he definitely would have received a yellow card. Now, some people arguing it was maybe a straight red. I don't think it was quite that bad. I don't think it was malicious. I think it was just a late challenge, but I do think it was a yellow card. But despite Newcastle players surrounding Pawson, he did not bring out a second yellow. And then almost immediately, Fabian Hertzler withdrew Wifa, replaced him with Tariq Lamptey. Is in that basically a concession of, he possibly could have been sent off. He's going to be sent off next time he makes a foul. That absolute classic sort of example of that. But then Tariq Lamptey with his first action, and Anthony Gordon, who was introduced just before that as well, with his first action, he cuts in from the left-hand side onto his right foot, completely does Lamptey, who sticks a foot out and catches him. Now, initially, Pawson points to the spot. VAR intervene and check it, because the contact is just outside the area. He falls into the box, but the contact's just outside the area. So at that point, Newcastle think they've been awarded a penalty opportunity to equalise, but that's the first penalty reward, which is rightly rescinded.
Yes, and that well, why don't you come on and just talk about the second and third penalties as well? You may as well. You're on a roll.
So then, in this roughly the 70th minute, Bruno Guimaraes has the ball, plays it in behind the Brighton defence, left hand side the box. Van der Heck is running back towards it, slides, and Joe Willock gets the ball just ahead of him, kicks it out of play, so probably doesn't have control of it. But from the angle I was in, from behind, initially I thought, that looks like a penalty. It looks like he's basically caught him. But when you saw the replay, it immediately became quite clear. Van Hegg had got up and basically he was arguing with the referee, and it became quite clear that Willock, although anticipating contact, Van Hegg had managed to pull out, and then Joe Willock threw himself to the ground, or whatever, however you want to say it, as momentum took him over, if you're being generous.
I think you're right. I think he was anticipating contact, and so he's gone down, and then the contact hasn't happened.
So then the referee, again, having initially pointed to the spot, he is told to go across to the monitor to actually view this one, rather than it just being... He was just told for the first one that it's outside the box, change of decision. This, he was recommended to go over to the monitor. He went over, checked it several times, and then determined that Joe Willock had dived, and so overturned the decision and then booked Willock, who Willock, similar to Wifa being hooked, was then almost immediately, you could argue almost unceremoniously hooked by Eddie Howe. And so at that point, you just felt that this wasn't going to be Newcastle United's day. And we'll come on to the third penalty incident. This is all the way in the last couple of minutes of the match. Harvey Barnes is fouled just outside of the area. I realise I'm talking a lot and doing a lot of explaining, but you know that's what I do. Harvey Barnes is fouled just outside of the box. Fabian Scher steps up to take the free kick from in the D, curls the free kick, gets goal-bound, and Yasser Nayari, another substitute, the substitute's had a lot of influence in this game, sticks out his arm quite clearly and blocks the ball, which is goal-bound. The referee is immediately whistling, but the ball ricochets to Callum Wilson, who heads it goalwards, probably should score. Verbruggen actually makes a wonderful save to deny that, but whether it would count in any way, I think it probably wouldn't, because the referee was already blowing. But then VAR intervenes again to look at it, because although Ayari clearly puts his hand towards the ball, depending on the angle you look at, there was some suggestions that maybe it didn't actually hit his arm, that it hit his leg. Eventually, when Newcastle have waited around for so long, that third penalty award is allowed to stand, rightly. And Alexander Isak, having twice thought that he was going to be taking a penalty previously, steps up and dispatches the penalty really nicely. What did you make of the actual finish, George? It wasn't quite a twatter, but it was a good finish.
It was beautifully placed and hit with enough power that it's unsavable. I mean, so, and yeah, and with that in that part of the net, you just can't stop that. And I just like to kind of praise him. I mean, it was a strange game, as you've said. He had barely been involved. You know, he wasn't involved in build-up play. He wasn't getting the ball in the box. And I think there are questions to be asked about his sort of form and fitness generally since Wembley. I think this hasn't been vintage Isak in terms of terrifying defences that we see him getting on the ball, running at players. You know, obviously everybody knows how dangerous he is, so teams, you know, teams do try to sort of manhandle him and control him. But I just think he's been sort of off form. Now, the incredible thing about that is that the goal tally has kind of kept ticking over. And yeah, I think to be in that position where you're twice preparing to take penalties in your head whilst VAR checks are kind of going on, and then to sort of take that third one with such iciness, I think is excellent. And yeah, he is not playing as well as he has done at times this season, but to be able to sort of to make the most of that big moment, I think does say a lot about his mentality. But yeah, that was one thing that I talked about earlier, was, you know, this didn't really feel like a day when Newcastle's sort of big players were at their best in terms of sort of dictating the game. I think Bruno had a difficult game. Isak obviously had a sort of difficult game. But our mate, he was constantly telling us how terrible everybody was. I think that by the end of the match, you do have to say that's a good point and a good performance, a decent performance, a draw at Brighton. Yeah, Brighton haven't been in sort of brilliant form recently, but if there was any team that were going to win it, that was going to win that game, it was Newcastle. They dominated possession, they dominated shots, they dominated chances, they dominated touches in the opposition box, all of those things. And in some ways, I've had to sort of re-watch the match.
All right, anyhow.
Well, no, but to like re-evaluate my opinion, because at the time, you felt like Newcastle need to win this match, and therefore it can only be 2 points dropped. But I think sort of with the cold light of day, I think it feels a bit different. I think that becomes a very useful point. Yes, it puts pressure on the games to come, but, you know, there's no divine right for Newcastle to sort of win every match. And the fact that they got a point there in those circumstances, I think is actually a really positive thing. And there were a lot of positive things to take from it, including the fact that the subs that came on did make a contribution. That hasn't always been the case this season. But I think for the first time, we saw a bit of the Callum Wilson you'd want to see coming on. He looked much sharper, much quicker. You mentioned that chance towards the end. There was another chance he had before the end. He forced a save. He didn't get a great ball through, but still took it on and forced a great save from the Brighton keeper. Gordon came on immediately, you know, wins that penalty that wasn't. Again, he looked sharper. And that, to me, was a source of encouragement too.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I asked Howe about the tactical change second half, because he actually went 4-4-2. Usually, well, one of the criticisms he often gets is that he makes like-for-like changes. And when he took Joe Willock off almost immediately after he was booked, Wilson was put up top with Isak. And I thought Isak looked a bit better for that. He still didn't really get any chances beyond the penalty. But Howe said that he was reluctant in one sense to change it because he thought Newcastle had control of the game without really threatening all the time. And so he almost rolled the dice to a certain degree. And I think that you saw that because I think the game became more open. But in some ways that suited Newcastle. They didn't have control as much, but they also got more opportunities to get Gordon and Barnes one-on-one with players to get Callum Wilson into those opportunities and those spaces. And I agree, I think, I mean, there was 9 minutes of added time. Newcastle, beyond the Wilson chance, didn't really look like scoring. Brighton had one massive opportunity from a header, which they should have scored from a set piece. How he missed, I have no idea. But beyond that, Newcastle were the team who looked more likely to score. And I found the big players debate a strange one, in the sense that, as you say, for a start, that they recovered and got a draw. Alexander Isak, was he at his best? Was Sandro Tonali at his best? Was Bruno Guimaraes at his best? No, I'd argue certainly Sandro Tonali, that's probably his worst performance of 2025 so far. But they kept grinding it out and they found a way. And also, players aren't robots. They can have off days, and some can even have difficult runs of form, like Alexander Isak has spoken publicly about how he's had an ongoing groin issue, whether that's affecting him or whether mentally, psychologically, he isn't quite sure in his body. I can't answer those questions, but I do think a point away at Brighton, regardless of how you think Newcastle's performance is still a very good result. Newcastle's record there suggests that. Newcastle generally picking up points away from home. As I've written in my piece overnight, the top 10 sides this season, when Newcastle fall behind, they tend to go on and lose. They got hammered at Aston Villa. They got hammered at Manchester City. They lost very comfortably at Liverpool, having conceded early. They lost at Brentford in that game where, you know, I had the meltdown on the way back. Newcastle don't often recover. They'd only won one when they'd fallen behind early on, and that was against Nottingham Forest in November when they played very well. They got a point at Bournemouth very early on in the season, fortunately, as well. This is not, it's not an easy position to recover from, and you can argue maybe they shouldn't have got themselves in that position to begin with, but they did, and they ground out and found a way, and this was their first draw. They'd gone 20 Premier League games out of draw, which was a Premier League record for them. They'd never been in that position before, and largely that was a positive thing because they won 14 of those games. They were that is what's driven them into the position that they are in. But when they don't win games, they've tended to lose them, and often quite heavily. This was a positive in that sense for me. They needed that point in the, when you look at the table and where they are. It keeps things within their hands. Would they have ideally won the game? Yes, but they couldn't, and therefore they had to just make sure they got a point from it. If they hadn't had a point, I think that there would have been a lot more trepidation going into next weekend, because given results that happened afterwards, they would be behind Chelsea in the table. They would not necessarily have their fate as comfortably in their own hands as they do, and therefore I actually came out largely on the positive side of things.
I do think that is sort of fascinating. I think, you know, I did a piece which you helped me with last week about this extraordinary form that Newcastle have been in. 20 wins in 26 games in all competitions before Brighton. That 14 out of 19 wins in the Premier League, as you say. Now, that is the kind of form that should have Newcastle being talked about as potential champions. That's over half a season. And so I kind of asked that question. And there were lots of caveats. But, you know, this is the kind of form that Newcastle had in 95-96, for example, at the start of that season when Kevin Keegan's team were 10 points clear in the Premier League. So it is that sort of level of form. But what makes it different, and why doesn't it sort of feel like that? Because, as you say, when Newcastle don't win, they have lost. And whether it's Aston Villa 4-1, or as you said, Man City, heavy defeat away from home in which they didn't lay a glove on Pep Guardiola's team, to the Fulham defeat at home, to the Bournemouth defeat at home. And so it sort of doesn't feel like that extraordinary, amazing, favourite season sort of feeling, because they've lost those games. It's so important to keep the scoreboard ticking over. Now, that's what Liverpool have done in the same period of time. Only Liverpool have won more games than Newcastle this season. But when they haven't won, they've tried to make sure that they don't lose. And I think they've only lost a couple of games. So that's the reason why they're champions this season. They've been much more consistent. But, you know, it's very difficult to say that Newcastle's form has been anything other than extraordinary, because it has. And this point at least keeps the scoreboard ticking over, and it keeps them ahead of Chelsea, albeit on goals scored, I believe. Goals scored. And of course, it's Chelsea next. Chelsea beat understrength Liverpool following the Newcastle game, and it tees up that big game at St James's Park very, very nicely. We will come on to that after talking about Newcastle women after this little break.
They'll be back, and in greater numbers.
So on to the Lasses, and they finished their championship season, their first season in the second tier of women's football, with a hammering of Blackburn Rovers. 5-1 victory for Becky Langley's side. It was only 1-0 at half-time, but then second half, they really seemed to pull away, didn't they, George? Seemed very, very positive way to end the season.
Oh, extraordinary, yeah. Another hat-trick for Shania Hales, her second of the season, which means she ends the season with 15 goals, which is excellent in the championship. Also goals from Deanna Cooper, and a beautiful lob, by all accounts, from Freya Gregory. And then a very special moment towards the end, when Grace Donnelly, Newcastle's record appearance maker, comes on to make her debut in the championship in what was her final game before she leaves the club. So a very special moment. Sadly for her, Blackburn got one back at that time. Newcastle gave away a penalty. But anyway, a lovely moment. And Newcastle end the season really strongly, in great form, four games unbeaten, and it leaves them fifth in the table, which, you know, it's an incredibly tight division, as we've been saying all the way through the season. Is that reflective of how good Newcastle have been? I'm not entirely sure. But I do know somebody who is able to put all of that into context the manager, Becky Langley, who joins us for a very special extended interview to pick apart the season and to look what might be in store for Newcastle's future.
Stokes, nicely done. Gregory gives it back to Demi Stokes. Floats into a good area. Hales with a header. You know the rest. Brilliant delivery from Demi Stokes. And a really tidy, clever finish from Shania Hales.
So, Becky, thank you so much for joining us. What a way to go out for you. That was a huge win at Blackburn and also four games unbeaten in the league.
Yeah, fantastic way to end the season. Really good performance, especially in that second half against Blackburn at Ewood Park. And four games unbeaten to finish the season against some good opposition who finished ahead of us in the table. And just a fantastic day and really good one for the memories. And especially, of course, our Grace Donnelly kind of bowing out in style.
You must be ready for a rest. I'm sure you are. I'm sure the players are too. But in a funny way, do you wish this was sort of just the start of the season?
Of course. I think I wish I knew then more what I know now. And there's been so much learning and experience gained across the season. Yeah, we've really enjoyed it. I think it's the biggest thing. We've enjoyed the moments with the fans. We've enjoyed the memories. But it's the little margins, isn't it, across the season where we're going. You know, we were 2 points off finishing fourth, 3 points off finishing third. A little gap between us, London City and Birmingham. But at the same time, we've got to go. We've finished 7 places higher than the previous season. We've moved mountains again in terms of our development on and off the pitch. And we're competing against some top teams, teams that have had a heavy amount of investment, such as your London Cities and Birmingham's, and teams such as Charlton, Durham, Bristol, Sunderland, who've been in this league, you know, 10 years plus. So our first season, it's a good platform to build on for next season. And I think it's just about ensuring that growth is on a really quick upward trajectory for next season.
I can't go any further without saying congratulations as the manager of the month as well. You end the season manager of the month. That's a brilliant achievement. Well done. How different are you as a manager at the end of your season in the Championship, or what have you learnt? How are you feeling about your own kind of progress as a manager?
Yeah, firstly, I'm absolutely delighted to win manager of the month. It was a target of mine at the start of the season. I was reviewing that last night, kind of my professional and personal targets across this 12 months period. And I thought I might not have actually got that target ticked off to come right in the last month, which is credit to everybody's hard work. I can't take all the plaudits for the success of the team across April. It's all the dedication from staff and players day in, day out to make that possible. But for me individually, I am absolutely buzzing to have got that kind of award. And it's something I was really proud when the LMA called me to let me know, because I have worked really hard across the season to try and achieve that.
When you talk about the small margins in terms of the difference in matches, what does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah, I think it's moments where we've just been a little bit naive. If I reflect on certain games across the season and look, our playing style has massively adapted across the season in terms of, you know, how we need to play to get out of this league. And, you know, we've been one of the best teams in this league in terms of being aggressive, high pressing, the DNA of the football club in terms of, you know, when we lose the ball, we want to win it back instantly. We want that immediate pressure on the ball. And some of our stats across the season have been the best pressing team, the most high press shots. We've actually scored joint top the most goals in the league this season. We've had the most entries into the final third. So we're an offensive, attacking, driven team, which you'd imagine from any team that really pulls on a black and white shirt. But I think there's moments where we have been slightly naive. I reflect back to the game against Charlton where we're 3-1 up at home with 4 minutes to go, and you know, we go down to 10 players, and I would change what I did tactically. I'm sure the players would change some of their decision making on the pitch before the sending off and after the sending off. So there's moments we would definitely tweak with that. Set pieces, how big a part of the game they are for us in terms of defending and attacking. The best teams in the league score the most goals from attacking set players. So the way we coach, our time spent on, you know, defending and attacking corners, our wide free kicks, our ability to score direct from free kicks. We've done a lot more work during the week through that towards the end of the season, which has really helped. So there's so many things that we've reflected on. You know, you can't drop points to teams who are below us in the league. We've dropped two big points to Sheffield United away at the start of 2025. And it's like, if we don't concede from that, we would be finishing third in the league. So I think the stuff in terms of like the trends of women's football, the trends of football, you know, teams want to be that creative team that plays out from the back. But, you know, as the seasons went on, I'm like, it's a pandemic of playing out. Are we actually causing more goals and errors that are actually cost us points across the season? And actually the benefit of almost playing total football, making football look beautiful. Of course, we want it to look that way. But at the same time, it's we're here to win. We're here to play games to win. So our style, can we be direct in the right moments? Can we take pride in actually being a really dominant team without the ball? So yeah, there's things that I wish I'd reflected on a bit more at the start, and we'll definitely reflect on in this off season going into the new season. But yeah, I think there's been some incredible moments. You know, the Northeast piece is one to reflect on. You know, we wanted to finish the highest Northeast team. We've fell 2 points short of that. But I think what we take a huge amount of pride in is the fact we were able to bounce back from the disappointments against Durham, and we were able to put in some magnificent performances and results against Sunderland at both, you know, St James's Park and earlier in the season at the Stadium of Light.
I have to say, I've got slight hair standing up on the back of my neck there, hearing you talk about the pandemic of playing out. You are talking my language there. I mean, I love the fact that teams are sort of desperate to play good football now, and that we've got great players who want to express themselves. But this sort of idea of philosophy managers insisting on only playing a certain way, their way, to the detriment of results sometimes, I kind of love that. And I think that sort of pragmatism you talk about there is very interesting too, because you've had two seasons. I mean, let's face it, we've had two seasons. I know it's been incredibly hard work, but of basically steamrolling two divisions. Yeah. And I talked to you last season, and you sort of talked about that thing of standing in the tunnel before coming out and looking at the opposition and almost knowing that you'd won those games before the start. This has been very, very different from the first kick of the football, hasn't it? It's like, this is a step up and this is going to be a completely different challenge.
I think we knew we're up against some really strong teams in this division. And like I said, really experienced managers and teams who've been in the Women's Championship for many years, and teams that have actually been in the Women's Super League and have dropped down to the Championship. So we knew the experience of Bristol City would bring to this division. Players playing in the WSL last season, and, you know, to finish higher than them is, you know, a great achievement as well. But I think in terms of playing identity, I think it's so hard to be really clear with that when you've had a big turnover of players again in terms of that summer transfer window. So we have working principles of how we want to play, but really having that clear strategy and being quite comfortable with that does take time. And I think it maybe took us a bit too long to actually be comfortable in terms of what are our strengths and how do we want to play this season. And you've kind of seen that probably more towards the end of the season with a bit more identity about the team. We really struggled in terms of the fitness of the squad this season, in terms of keeping people injury free. And we've done a lot of work with James Bunce, Paul Mitchell going into next season, really trying to ensure that facilities and everything are in a much stronger place so that we are looking after the players better. The medical provision is doubled compared to the start of pre-season. We had one physio at the start of the pre-season and last season. So in terms of having that real wraparound support for the players and being able to access the medical facilities at the men's first team has really helped. And I have to say, you know, Paul Mitchell has been an incredible support with that. He's very much given the girls equal access to the men's facilities, and that has really helped across the season, especially towards the latter stages. So, yeah, there's so many things on and off the pitch that have evolved. And, yeah, we're just improving in terms of staffing structure and, new budgets and everything going into next season.
That's a kind of really fascinating point too. It's been a whirlwind of change, obviously, over the past kind of couple of seasons, coming under the club's umbrella, finally, belatedly, but the right thing to do. You going full-time professional, the team going full-time professional, two promotions, loads of signings, players leaving. I mean, you know, it's been an incredible success story. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But actually retaining foundations must be quite tough when you have all of that change. And I'm sure there's more change coming this summer too.
Yeah, it's incredibly tough. When I was in Tier 4 and Tier 3, it was really easy to bang the same drum. We play for the badge, we play for the black and white shirt. Everyone's a fan. Everyone loves it. And everyone's willing to, you know, die for the badge. And I think as you evolve, you bring in players who are not from the area. It takes time for them to understand what it means to be a Geordie and what it means to be a part of the club and what the city embodies, you need to embody as players. So that passion, that high energy, that working class mentality towards the team. And it takes time for everybody to gel and work together and understand that. And, you know, we've tried our best to really give everyone that feel of what it means to play here. But you only get that real feel when it sinks in for you as an individual, I guess. So what's hard is obviously when those core Geordie players leave the group. We lost some really good characters last year in terms of they weren't quite at the level in terms of playing ability, but they were great people in the group. They were really upbeat in the environment. They kept it fun. They brought the energy in. And I really meant that last season when everybody who helped us win that league as a player and a staff member contributed massively, whether they played every minute or whether they were almost a supporter in the stands. And that's, again, a lesson we need to learn going into next season without the likes of a Grace, without the likes of a Fernie, without the likes of Georgia Gibson being a part of things. It's very much going, right, how do we still keep that love for the club, that identity, that family piece, that togetherness when we don't have those characters around? But I think they've left such a big legacy and have left a real imprint on how we want to be as a football club here with the women's team. And I'm sure they'll get involved in coaching and other parts of the club that'll still keep that, all the good work that they bring to the club in-house.
This is an aggressively ambitious football club. We know that. Can we foresee more change over the summer?
Yeah, of course. And it's the hardest part of the job, without a doubt. I'm sure they feel that on the men's side when you see the likes of a Paul Dummett leave the football club, you know, players like that who've and massive fans who bring so much energy of being at the club a lot of years. It's similar with us in terms of those players that are a part of the journey and then not being on the journey for the next chapter. And it's the part where you've got to make tough decisions, is they're not decisions for you. You can't be sentimental with them. Like, if it was on people's character alone, there's so many players that would still be here in terms of across the years because they're bloody brilliant people. But at the same time, you've got to make decisions for the football club to get them as high as possible. So, yeah, we want to be building on that top five finish and really competing next season. And we need to be bringing in the best calibre players from all across the globe. You know, we've invested in a head of recruitment and analysis who's coming in to help drive that recruitment. We've got head of performance who's just come in to oversee all that medical and sports science provision. And who will help with the operations of away trips and making sure we're, you know, providing the players with the best support for optimal performance. So there's been so much learning on and off the pitch with that. And it's an aggressive mentality towards being the best and really going for it next season again, but recognising the amount of strides we've made this season to get the team to be competing for that third spot.
I'm interested in your thoughts sort of generally about what's happening in the WSL and the Championship at the minute. There's obviously the talk about, well, there's going to be a vote about the WSL expanding up to 16 teams eventually with no relegation. What are your thoughts on that and the general state of the top two divisions?
It's an interesting one because I think if the league is locked, it gives them incentive to owners to actually put more finances into the teams because their money is ring-fenced. It's safe that if a team gets relegated, their investment isn't lost, I guess. But I think the other part, obviously, is the competitive edge of it. You know, if you think you can get relegated, there's an edge to it because you have to perform every week. There's not that safety blanket there. So that part of me probably doesn't sit with me that well. But at the same time, we want to be one of those teams in that division. We want to be competing in the WSL and going from there. But I think the problem is with both divisions, there is a disparity between the top and the bottom in terms of that financial investment. Reading had folded the start of this pre-season, so they couldn't financially support their women's team in the Championship that season. And then, You've got the likes of a London City with a Michelle Kang, who's got huge amounts of finances to be pumping into the team, you know, who's offering players huge salaries, who've come from Women's Champions League to be a part of the Women's Championship. So how does a Blackburn Rovers or a Sheffield United or a Reading compete with the likes of a London City, a Birmingham, a Newcastle United, a Bristol City? And it's the same in the WSL. You know, the top teams in the WSL know that, you know, there's always going to be a top five pool of teams because they're the most financially supported.
You were playing at the same time, so it's a bit of an unfair question. But when you know or see that London and Birmingham are effectively having a shootout to see who kind of goes up, is part of you thinking to yourself, I want that to be us next season? Is part of you thinking, I need that to be us next season? Obviously, I know you've talked about sort of in kind of quieter moments, not putting pressure on yourself necessarily, but saying you all wanted to go back to back to back in terms of promotions. How do you feel about next season?
When I saw London City had went up, I thought that was a positive for us going into next season because I understand the financial investment they're pumping into it. So having them out of the league was a positive for us. In terms of us, yeah, we're eager for that to be us. I was reflecting on my professional targets for the season, and the target I'd spoken with Sue and Darren Eales, our CEO, about was for this season, a target should be a top five finish. Now, I'd actually written top five finish, however, ideally top three, and then in capital letters, ideally, dream is to win the championship this season and do the North Star of back-to-back. Yeah. But in brackets, Becky, you must do this within three seasons because it needs to be achieved. It needs to be pushed as quick as possible. So, yeah, my ambitions will be to help the team win the championship next season. And, yeah, anything less than that, I probably won't think is good enough from all the learnings we've made this season. But other targets I'd written were to do the double over Sunderland, which we've done, to beat Durham as a personal one for me, which obviously is why that game, especially the second one, stings so hard on the day of the Men's Cup final. Another target of mine was to beat a WSL team this season, which we came really close to against Everton but didn't achieve. Other targets that I'd have written across the season, obviously, which I won't go into, but the other three that I'd written, which I thought was quite good to share, was I'll read what I've actually written off my screen. I'd put keep learning from my colleagues. I've got so many good people to learn from: Sue, Claire, Brassy, and powers of above at the club. Really take time to invest and learn from the older, more experienced players in my squad every day, which I can't speak more highly of the likes of Rachel Furness for that, Deanna Cooper, her experience from Chelsea's been invaluable for me. Demi Stokes, obviously, her experience on and off pitch. And players, you know, who are a little younger, who've got some good experiences as well. There's been some great conversations across the season from them. I'd also put, enjoy being in the best job ever. People would give their right arm to do what you do. Make the club, my family and the city proud. Build a team of people that care, show passion and just love the project, and create a team that people want to play for and want to be a part of. And I think the bit with that is, you know, every player who's a part of this, who's either, you know, as the contract comes to an end, they either desperately want to renew it to stay at the club, or if they've chosen to leave, they don't actually want to leave. They just know that they want game time. There's not a single player in this squad that doesn't want to be here. Yeah. And I think that's something I'm really proud of, because we make it enjoyable every day. And yeah, it's a great place to be.
You talk about making the city proud. You've absolutely done that. You're an absolute credit. We're very, very lucky to have you. It's been a brilliant season. It's just been wonderful seeing the team's kind of progression, learning as they go this season. And yeah, you talk about some of the big moments. Obviously, the other one was that, you know, that huge crowd at St James's. That's become something we're more familiar with. I thought one of the interesting things was that final day crowd against Birmingham at home, more than 4,000 people, families there, kids there. You know, lots of young women there watching these brilliant young women players representing the city so well. So, I, you know, from a personal perspective, I'd just like to say thank you very much and keep up the good work.
Yeah, brilliant. And thank you, George. I think, yeah, it goes without saying, the crowd at St James's Park for that game, we smashed the championship record. And to have 38,500 fans is just incredible. And, you know, I think it was the couple of weekends later, we actually went to Charlton away and we were at the Valley, and it's a beautiful stadium. Yeah. And I looked round and I went on my phone to see how many it actually held, and it held something like 27,000. And I was like, wow, if we played here, we would fill this stadium more for our women's team than what Charlton men actually fill for their men's team. So it's just incredible, the magnitude of fans, the support in the away fixtures as well, George, is unbelievable. Like, we're at Ewood Park on Sunday and there's more Geordies than there is Blackburn fans. And yeah, as you're referring to, the support we had for the Birmingham and the London City game at Kingston Park was phenomenal. And it was so close, 1-1 and 2-1 defeat in those games, and we were arguably the better team in both.
Yeah.
Those teams are punching right at the top of the league. So it shows how close we are, and we've given ourselves a fantastic platform and foundations to really kick on from there.
Loads of space for Furness into Hales, back to Joel. Furness wants it back. Hales gets it back, and Shania Hales has a hat-trick. Shania Hales has 3, Newcastle have 5.
Love it. I will if we beat them. Love it.
So not that it needs any introduction, but Sunday, St James's Park, 12 p.m, Newcastle United, who are 4th in the Premier League, against Chelsea, who are currently 5th in the Premier League. Asterix, Nottingham Forest still play tonight as we're speaking Monday, although they would need a 9-goal swing to be able to leapfrog either of those teams. It's a huge occasion, everyone knows it is, and even if the kickoff time is absolutely rubbish, because for TV reasons, initially the game was penciled in for Saturday at 12:30, so it could be shown broadcast in the UK by TNT Sports in their usual slot. But everyone knew that in all likelihood Chelsea were going to get through to the UEFA Conference League semi-final, which they duly have done, and therefore this game was going to be shifted to 12 o'clock on a Sunday. Not ideal in terms of timing, but I know a few club insiders who've already referred to it as basically being the biggest league game of the season. Not quite winner takes all, but it could be a huge tone setter, a huge momentum shift for either side, depending on the result. George, how are you feeling? I mean, we're still 6 days out, but how are you feeling for this one?
Yeah, I'm sort of interested that people are calling it that. I do understand it. And of course, it's the next game in front of the club and it's against Chelsea. And so the Champions League kind of race is coming into sharper focus. I'm sort of not surprised in some ways that they're referring to it like that. But, you know, I also think about this as being a transformative season for Newcastle. Anyway, they've already had some absolutely huge occasions, whether it's been the Cup or in the league this season. You know, if I think about sort of huge matches, I would go back to the 14th of December in that game, that home game against Leicester, after the Brentford game, where they've lost 4-2, they're 12th in the table. It's been a week of massive reset at the club. And, you know, I don't think there's been a bigger game for that than Newcastle this season. And in the end, that turned out to be really, really straightforward. And it was exactly what Newcastle needed at the time. They then go on a run of nine games unbeaten. It's, you know, Man United away, where Newcastle win for only the second time since the 70s. It's the only thing left to play for now, isn't it? The variety of European football that's on offer for the clubs at the top of the table. So I kind of get that. But I do think I would want to sort of slightly shy away from that hype a little bit. Newcastle have already hit their targets this season. They've got a place in Europe next season, which was the target all the way back in July and August. They've won a trophy, which is something they've been striving for decades and decades. I think this is, I don't want to describe it as a free hit. I understand why the Champions League is really important in terms of prestige, in terms of revenue, in terms of signing players, in terms of keeping players. But I also don't like that sort of Sky Sports hypey thing. We've got to hype this up as the biggest game in the world. I think this is bonus territory for Newcastle, and I'm so impressed with them, the way they've responded post-Wembley. I mean, I would have just wanted to go out on the piss for 3 months and, you know, as I've said before, play John Ruddy up front. I don't care. But the way they've responded has been magnificent. Would this season end up being a disappointment if Newcastle don't get over the line in terms of the Champions League? No, I can't possibly say that. This is already automatically their best season in living memory. It has to be. But yeah, I want them to do it, and I think they will, and I think they can. So I think this is a big game. It's a big, big game. It should be a good occasion. I would hope that St James's Park will be up for it, in spite of what you correctly point out, Chris, is a ludicrous kickoff time. But come on, they've already won a trophy. They're already in Europe.
Yeah, I slightly disagree with you in the sense that if you'd offered me at the start of the season, should Newcastle need to win a trophy or get in the Champions League, I was always of the opinion trophy was the big one. But I think that the amount that Newcastle have put into this, the position they've got themselves into, the desire and drive of Eddie Howe and the squad to want to get back into the Champions League, I do actually think this game is huge, because I think that if they win, then I struggle to see how they won't get into the Champions League. Whereas if they lose, I think it will be a little bit deflating. And I think that it could tinge slightly what is a hugely memorable season. It will be arguably the best season in the history beyond winning the championships early on, the top division of English football before, and it's going to be 100 years in 2 years' time since they've done that. But certainly in living memory, this is, as you say, they're already the most successful season, but it can be a truly historic one if they also get into the Champions League. I just think it can be transformative and so important for them. I'm starting to worry about the effects of... It looks like they're almost certainly going to be in the Europa League. They're guaranteed to be in the UEFA Conference League, but given the positions that lots of other clubs are in, the fact that Man City are in the FA Cup final, the fact that Chelsea could well win the UEFA Conference League, or probably will win the UEFA Conference League, there probably will be another Europa League slot, so the top seven will probably be in that competition. That concerns me going into next year and the effects that could maybe have, and the way that, you know, Thursday, Sunday football. But I agree with you, it shouldn't tarnish this season, but I also think that it is huge, and I can see why it has been. I don't think it's just Sky Sports are building up, I do think that there is an importance beyond that.
I've got a question for you here. I don't want you to talk about Champions League and what that's worth in terms of sort of money and being transformational in that sense. Would you prefer to be in the Champions League or to win the Europa League or the Conference League? Because I look at the Europa League and, like, if Spurs and Man United both have good chances of winning that competition, and, you know, Chelsea, we know what they're doing. I mean, I'd quite like to win a European competition. I mean, I think this is an interesting debate, because, like, Newcastle did get into the Champions League last season, and all of those occasions were extraordinary and memorable and, like, wonderful, and PSG at home, extraordinary. You know, like, one of the best occasions I've been to, if not the best. AC Milan away, I went to that. Just phenomenal being back at the San Siro, and, you know, strangely sort of emotional, which I didn't expect. But ultimately, they were just six games, and did it have a meaning for Newcastle last season? Yeah, in sort of lots of ways. But that was what it was. It was six games, six big games. You know, Newcastle didn't come close to winning it. You know, I totally accept that kind of getting back. I think getting back into the Champions League, you can then say that for two seasons out of three, Newcastle have been in the Champions League. That almost makes them a Champions League side, if you know what I mean, or a Champions League club. And I do accept it's important. But in purely football terms, all it is more games of football. And I'd prefer to win.
I think it's a wider debating point, which we should probably have at a different time, to really get into the nuts and bolts of this and maybe get Taylor.
Chris, if you hadn't wasted 10 minutes talking about Star Wars, we could have done it now.
I mean, because I don't entirely agree with you. I think that Thursday, Sunday football is very different. So for me, being in the Champions League is important. And I also think it's what the players want to be in, regardless of their star players want to be in. So not including monetary and financial reasons as to why it would be important, because you don't want them to be included. I also think in terms of psychologically for members of that first team squad, it's important. But anyway, as we've said, Forest are at Crystal Palace tonight, which is very awkward for us on the podcast because it's going to be going out on Tuesday at some point. Man City host Southampton on Saturday, and Villa are at Bournemouth on the same day. So Newcastle will have a clearer idea of the Champions League picture by kickoff, really. I mean, they will need to win regardless. It feels important in that sense that they win the final two home games, not particularly with a difficult trip to Arsenal coming up, even if they look vulnerable themselves. in terms of the 11, you mentioned the substitutes. Would you be making any changes to the side?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously the Willock for Jillinton change is really the only one that's happened in recent weeks. Has Anthony Gordon done enough to force his way back into the picture? I think that's a debate worth having. To retreat slightly, just the point we were making, I do think, though, that Newcastle should be the confident team. Nobody has budgeted at Newcastle to be in the Champions League. For teams like Chelsea, Arsenal, obviously Liverpool, Man City, others, it's minimum requirement territory. You'd say the same thing for Manchester United. You'd say the same thing for a club like Spurs as well. And it isn't minimum territory for Newcastle. Like I say, they've hit their targets. I hope that whoever starts, whoever plays, that Newcastle should be playing that completely without fear, with confidence, the confidence of already having hit their targets this season and knowing that they're good enough to do this. I was playing devil's advocate. I do understand why the Champions League is really important, but I'm feeling good about it. What do you think? Any other changes? I mean, we know that Jillinton is more or less ruled out for the rest of the season, don't we?
Yeah, so the debate would be, do you bring Lewis Smiley back or Joe Willock? We didn't really speak much about his performance. I thought a lot of people were harsh on Joe Willock at Brighton. Yes, he got booked for a dive, and when he attacked down the left early in the first half, should he have made a different decision to trying to shoot with the outside of his right boot? But I also think he tried to make things happen. It didn't always necessarily work, but I thought that he got on the ball, he was pushing forward with it. I think against Chelsea, he was very good against him in the cup earlier this year. I think at home, with the potential for it being maybe there'll be a bit more space and Chelsea will have a bit more of a go at Newcastle, I think it could be a game for him. I mean, Lewis Miley didn't even come on at Brighton, so I'd be surprised if he comes entirely out the side. Anthony Gordon, I thought the game changed when he came on and he won the penalty, which was overturned. I'm not sure he's yet done enough to earn a start and slot. I thought Harvey Barnes was busy again, even if final decision making was lacking. Jacob Murphy was poor, but I think he's better at St. James's Park, and I think that disrupting that front three, not necessarily something I would want to do yet. The big question mark is over Fabian Schär, because Howe was, as usual, coy self after the game, asking about the fact that Schär had basically limped off the pitch, and Howe said, I don't know whether that's fatigue or actually a muscle problem, which seemed fairly disingenuous, but equally I also get why. I mean, Fabian Schär tends to get these knocks and then seems to be all right. Sven Botman came on for him and played as that right side centre half, so they do have an option there, but I think that Schär will only come out if it is fully fitness enforced. So I don't expect many changes. The big call would be whether Gordon comes back in the team or not for me.
This is a very, very special position to be in. Again, you know, because the first half of the season was so difficult, it doesn't feel necessarily like this has been an entirely transformational season, but it has been. And what a half season of form Newcastle have shown since that Brentford game in December. They're in absolutely incredible form. And if they end the season in the same way as they're going now, then Newcastle will be in the Champions League next season. That is for certain. I guess we should probably round things off now, Chris.
I just wanted to pay a shout out to several people who came up to me and said that they love listening to the podcast. I chatted to quite a few on the way down. I chatted to a few on the platforms, waited for ages for trains which did not show up from the Amex Stadium back into Brighton. And then on the train from Brighton up to London, it just so happened that Sam Mulliner of NUFC Fans TV was sat directly next to me. Good to catch up with him, but you know.
I feel your pain, Sam. Well done for getting through that.
But yes, you wanted to give a shout out to someone as well, didn't you, George?
Yes, I'd like to mention Nathan, who I was at Gosforth Park last week, sitting in the sun. Do you remember the sun, Chris? That was lovely, wasn't it? Did you enjoy summer?
It was brief, but it was nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. Anyway, so I was doing a bit of work, doing a bit of research in Gosforth, and Nathan came over, and yeah, we were talking about the pod. He was just listening to it, or just been listening to it when he saw me. Talking about family and talking about the cup final. And yeah, I just want to say thanks for coming over, Nathan. And yeah, I'm pleased that you and your dad got to share Newcastle winning something, and to send you love and to send him love too.
Thank you very much for that. And hopefully Taylor Payne, as I say, will return next week, and we wish him all the best. Hope he's feeling better. If you want to get in touch, you can email podonthetyne@theathletic.com. You also have @podonthetyne on X, and we are also on Blue Sky. Wish you all a very, very happy week. Hopefully we shall be chatting about Newcastle defeating Chelsea and strengthening their grip on a top five position. But yeah, toodaloo, have a wonderful week and all the best.
Father, Chris.
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.